Support for Central Florida Public Media comes from the UCF College of Business, offering the new online space MBA. Designed for professionals in innovative and high-growth industries, beginning spring 2026, students gain advanced business skills through the lens of the space economy. Learn more at business.ucf.edu/space MBA.
The government shutdown hits NASA, and scientists find potential signs of life on Mars. You're listening to Are We There Yet?, the radio show exploring space exploration. Hi, I'm Brendan Byrne. With the U.S. government shut down, NASA employees are being sent home on furlough, and NASA science is on pause. So what long-term effects will this have on the space agency? We'll speak with NASAWatch.com's Keith Cowing about the shutdown and the potential impact on NASA's employees. Then we'll explore the timeless question, could there be life on another planet? Scientists have detected a potential biosignature on Mars, a possible sign of life on the red planet. We'll speak with NASA's Nikki Fox about this potential groundbreaking discovery, plus a look at space weather and other missions from NASA exploring the universe. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? From rockets launching the missions to explore distant icy moons to the satellites keeping an eye on our weather, it's the people behind the scenes at NASA that make it happen. During a government shutdown, the majority of science that doesn't involve the safety of astronauts is deemed non-essential, meaning that anyone who works in that category is on furlough until further notice. So while the International Space Station is up and running, for other NASA missions, it's kind of like NASA's doors are closed. Plus, this government shutdown is happening as Congress debates the agency's future and budget and is looking at cutting 25% across the board. Here to talk more about the shutdown and its impacts it would have on NASA is Keith Cowing. He's the editor of NASAWatch.com, which is not affiliated with NASA. Keith, welcome back to the show.
Yep, good to be here.
Right now, we're dealing with a government shutdown. What do we know the impacts are on the space agency?
Well, if you look at the numbers that I've been able to find, we're talking about somewhere 80 to 90%, depending how you look at not working, what that means. You have the accepted personnel who are there to make sure the place doesn't burn down or the astronauts are okay. Pretty much NASA's closed. Nothing's happening. No websites, no updates. The spacecraft are doing their thing, but that's about it.
As a journalist, it has been difficult to find those numbers, as you mentioned myself. We really don't know the full scope of this impact here, but we can kind of look back as to what happened at the last government shutdown, right? Are there any parallels to what happened the last time the government shut down under President Trump's first term?
Well, there are some parallels. I mean, I could take it back to when I was a NASA civil servant and they had a shutdown. It was a couple days off and then it was fixed. And over the decades, it's gotten worse. And the last three have been under Trump. And the last one before this was not particularly happy for anybody. It was a month. You know, when people don't go to work at any agency, especially when with rockets across the solar system, things don't get done. Things can break. Things get delayed. And it takes longer to catch up with what didn't happen than to not have been at work in the first place. And so we're going to see it this time in spades because everybody involved is wondering whether they'll actually have a job to come back to.
I have the opportunity to talk to a lot of people that worked for NASA or currently work for NASA, and they're very proud of what they do and a very passionate workforce. What is it like when you get that notice that you can't go to work and you literally cannot do something that you are so passionate about?
Well, at the time, and I know more about it from friends recently, but when it happened to us, I mean, we were working on the space station Freedom, the one before the one we have. We're always sort of under a threat of shutdown, so we kind of got used to it. But we used to have a contest, like hanging signs. Like I had one up once as Clean Phil Wanted, and then another one was, we'll build space station for food. It's a calling. I mean, it hit me when I was 6 years old in the 60s. And the younger you are when you get bit, the longer it lasts. And when you finally get the job, you're there. And when you can't do that job, odds are you got to pay the bills. But a lot of people work there decades after they could have retired, even at a very young age, because it's NASA, damn it.
There are certain essential services and jobs that stay there, right? Those that take care of the International Space Station. Who do we think is working at NASA right now? What are the essential jobs and duties that are happening?
Security folks. you know, going around. The fire departments have people there. The people that might have to be on call in case a hurricane comes into Florida, I don't know that that's an issue, but this time, but it's happened before. And mission control, you'll see it's fully staffed and pretty much anybody required to make sure mission control works. And then all the folks that run the communication system so that they can talk to the station. And then to the extent that there's still activity going on the space station, the science, probably at Marshall Space Flight Center and elsewhere, you'd have a handful of people who are running that, but it's a skeleton crew. And literally, you know, the janitors aren't there. They will pull anybody that doesn't actually have to be there to protect the property and lives of American citizens doing the space stuff. So it's the hallways are empty.
Central Florida Public Media, we spoke with Republican Congressman Mike Haradopoulos, who said that he was hearing that programs like Artemis are spared for this. Do you think the work that's being done on Artemis is essential, or should that be employees elsewhere be spared from these shutdowns?
Well, not under the usual definition. And of course, I remember, I don't know if I broke that news, but it's out there. And I posted it. And then yesterday, now we find out that the people who work on the SLS and other parts of Artemis, well, hey, we're important too. If that work stops, will the agency stop? No. Will anybody get hurt? No. Is it important? Yeah. Everything NASA does is important. And otherwise, they wouldn't be doing it. You really get what you pay for or don't get paid for. And they made this decision. OMB apparently has signed off on it. Or if they haven't, they'll get shut down soon.
Let's talk about something you mentioned earlier in our conversation, Keith, where the longer this stays shut down, the harder it is to get things back up and running. You know, we're talking about scientific missions that are throughout our solar system, Earth observation satellites that are looking back down on Earth. What is that process like when nobody is actually monitoring these things? And then how difficult is it to bring them all back online when folks are called back, whenever that may be?
Yeah, I used to have this thing when I worked at NASA. I named it the eponymous, you know, Cowling's rule of delays. The longer you're on a delay, the more reasons you have to say, hey, you know what? I didn't fix that thing last time. I started to fix it. But, now, you know, you come up with reasons to not go back to work. But that competes with everybody saying, we really want to go back to work. And so, you know, some of the stuff is simple. You know it's coming. You change your email. You say, you cancel meetings and all that routine stuff. But if you've got a spacecraft, for example, that's on Mars and it's programmed to do some stuff, but you got to look over its shoulder. You got to make sure the tests are completed, that the data goes where it needs to go. Some of those folks are there because, you know, looking over the shoulder of the robot is still required. And so they're there, but you know, again, the person sitting in back of them who may be the backup isn't there. So you may be buffering things, putting them in boxes, putting them aside, which is fine for 2 or 3 days. But if this becomes one of these long drawn out things, you're then saying, you know, I may postpone that sortie to that crater, or I may not sample this. And it starts to build over time. And now you got to go back and grab that stuff later with the stuff you're supposed to now be doing.
Are there any concerns that stuff will fall out of the sky, Keith, or maybe those Martian rovers will roll themselves into a crater? Like, I mean, do we have to worry about loss of missions during this shutdown?
No, I know the face-eating Martians know when to stay away from Earth. And, you know, the rocks, we won't suddenly have rocks hitting, you know, the important buildings that they always hit in the movies. No, and again, a lot of that is exempted. The space station will be taken care of. If they have to do an avoidance maneuver for debris, they'll do it. You know, if something's coming in, NORAD will push a button, say, hey, and that'll be taken care of. But there may be some maintenance issues that would require somebody on the ground to be talking to the crew and so forth that are delayed. Anything you delay from the time you're supposed to do it, you run a risk with that. And when you start getting into weeks and months, that could become a concern. But you know, you're not supposed to work during these things. You're prohibited by law, the Anti-Deficiency Act. But this is, like I said, this is NASA, damn it. We're not going to let the place break. And they'll figure out the ways that need to come into keeping things not afloat, but not crashing into each other to a point.
You're listening to Are We There Yet? The radio show exploring space exploration from Central Florida Public Media. I'm Brendan Byrne. We're speaking with Keith Cowing. He's the editor of NASAWatch.com about the government shutdown and its impact on NASA and space exploration. Keith, this shutdown is coming at a time where NASA is also facing a 25% budget cut to its science missions. What is it like inside the halls of NASA as an employee? This has got to be just another kick to the gut of morale, right?
Let me tell you my own history, because it reflects what I'm seeing. I was at Space Station Freedom. We were more or less torn apart by politics. Our jobs went across the country. And then, you know, 2 years later, the problems reemerged. You know, we kind of knew for a while we were going to get shut down, but it's always hanging over you. But, you're just doing it. And the most important thing to us was, as they were literally moving furniture out, we concluded the first 6 mission PDR. We handed that to the new program, and we felt we'd left the place in good hands and we couldn't do anything else. But out of that came the frustration of, hey, Keith, did you hear something? You know, what became NASA Watch a few years later, when the RIF was, it used to be called NASA RIF Watch. That came and went. People were upset by it, but then they got over it. But then it sort of didn't go away from me, my perspective, because other issues came up, whether you're crashing things into Mars, losing space missions. And so over time, you know, NASA at the end of the day is its people, full stop. I mean, you get all the toys and the gizmos, but it's about people. I have been covering about everything you can imagine, from astronauts in diapers to, again, crashing into Mars. I have never seen NASA this freaked out, and I've been involved with it as an employee or elsewise for 40 years. Everybody, literally from the top floor down, is freaked out by what could happen. Some of them are afraid they're being asked to do things illegally. And if they don't, they'll be fired. They don't know what's going to happen to their mission. And it's very depressing. There's a light at the end of the tunnel. And I've been trying to be optimistic. It's not a train coming at you. It's a starship. I mean, but you can cheer each other up only so much. And at the end of the day, NASA doesn't run on budgets and dollars to the point that it's a calling, and people do this because they are space people. They are explorers. And as one of my graphics says, we're explorers, not sheep. And that grinds on you, especially if you could have been doing something else, but here you are and you're being punished for wanting to explore the universe. I mean, it drives you nuts. We're all only human at the end of the day. So, long answer, it sucks. And it sucks for everybody right now.
We talked about this last time when we were discussing the risks, the reduction in workforce. We invited you on here because of how tapped into the NASA workforce you are as editor of NASAWatch.com. You know, with these reductions in workforces, with these concerns and worries about where the agency is going under this presidential administration, where are these passionate people going?
You see all this happening, and if I find a job opening for somebody, that I'll send it to them. And Europe, they're saying, hey, you know, if you can come over, you see ads for European Space Agency, Canada to some extent, the private sector is trying to pick it up, but it's a zero-sum game to some extent. And a lot of NASA people, even if you were to say, oh, we were just kidding, come on back, you're not going to get everybody back. They've said, that's it. They've burned the badge. They're taking the retirement the spouse wanted them to take 10 years ago or whatever. Or they're just doing something else. They're taking up painting. Every time you have one of these, it's a logarithmic asymptotic function. The longer you do this, and the more depressing and oppressing the process is of getting rid of people, the fewer people you get back. The ones that stay are the ones who are desperate. The young hires, they're the first to go. So you end up with a lack of diversity that's worse than what it was before. And a lot of these people just want to hide under their desk until it's all over. That's not how you explore the universe.
Finally, Keith, as someone who has been through this before and knowing that there are some employees that are probably being affected by this that listen to this show, do you have any words of wisdom or advice for them during this time?
We'll get through this. You know, it may be difficult. There may be a diaspora. People will spread out, but you know, you can leave NASA, but NASA never leaves you. And there may be a chance someday in the future where you're going to have a chance to contribute again in one way or another. And it may well just be you're in the line at a shopping center and you say, yeah, NASA's explaining to somebody. The bug bites. It's a lifelong infection. Wrap your arms around it, and you didn't waste your life doing this, and you have something left to offer somewhere, somehow. It may have nothing to do with NASA, but you can point back to NASA as giving you those skills.
Keith Cowing, editor of NASAWatch.com. Keith, thanks for joining us. Are We There Yet? Reached out to multiple NASA contacts asking about potential impacts to the agency due to the shutdown and did not receive any responses. Still to come, finding potential life on Earth's neighbor.
What we think it is basically like food for a microbe, like breakfast, and then essentially poop. It's the excrement of a microbe.
Evidence of life on Mars, plus understanding space weather. That's ahead on Are We There Yet?
Yeah. Support for Central Florida Public Media comes from the UCF College of Business, offering the new Online Space MBA, designed for professionals in innovative and high-growth industries. Beginning spring 2026, students gain advanced business skills through the lens of the space economy. Learn more at business.ucf.edu/space MBA.
You're listening to Are We There Yet?, the radio show exploring space exploration from Central Florida Public Media. I'm Brendan Byrne. Gardening in space. It's way more important than you think. That's because if we want humans to live and work in space for longer periods of time, plants are a necessity. One scientist is working to understand how space travel impacts plant life, going so far as to launching himself and his plants into space. Understanding how we can have a green thumb off our planet, that's next week on Are We There Yet? But for now, we are talking about space weather and how scientists might have found signs of life off our planet. First, NASA's IMAP mission launched to explore our sun, and most importantly, to look at how our sun affects weather on Earth and in space. And the agency is one step closer to potentially finding out if Mars once had ancient life. The Perseverance rover found a sample that looks like there could have been ancient life on the red planet. We're talking the latest scientific discoveries from NASA with Nikki Fox, who is the Associate Administrator for the Science Mission Directorate at NASA. Nikki, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much.
There's been a ton of great NASA science launching, including IMAP. I know you were at the Kennedy Space Center for this launch. Tell us a bit about what you're so excited about this mission.
It is actually going to be supporting Artemis 2 and Artemis 3. It is going to be providing really critical data to let us know about the radiation environments that our astronauts are traveling through. So if you think about setting up a sustained presence on the moon, you're actually going to have astronauts that are not in the protective bubble that the Earth's magnetic field forms. They're behind the Earth with the sun in front, then they're in that sort of protective bubble. But then they pop out and the moon spends a lot of time in the pristine solar wind. And so, you know, really making sure that we understand what's coming from the sun and how it is affecting what our astronauts are actually experiencing is really, really critical for us. IMAP does that in two ways, basically measuring everything coming from the sun and then packaging that up into the data that we need to be able to tell our astronauts. It's called iAlert, and that is basically the real-time IMAP space weather stream that is going to the astronauts. That's really important, but it also has these really unusual measurements that it makes of the far out regions of our solar system. So as the sun, you know, the sun sort of giveth and taketh away, it is sending radiation out, which we have to worry about for our astronauts. It's creating space weather that we sometimes have to worry about for our technology, but it is also carving out a protective bubble for our solar system as we orbit around the Milky Way, making sure we understand that boundary. And that is what IMAP is doing. It is actually going to be producing data that will allow us to do images of what that boundary looks like and how it's changing. That's important because that boundary keeps out kind of all the vagaries of interstellar space. So things like, you know, very high energy galactic cosmic rays, even though it a lot kind of is kept out by this boundary, some still gets through. And that needs to be part of the forecast and awareness that we're giving to our astronauts when they're on the surface of the moon. And also, of course, as we set our eyes to Mars and they have a long journey in deep space.
You know, here on Earth, you know, these solar winds, they can affect, you know, our satellites. What risks does it pose to astronauts on the moon, let's say?
Well, so if we go back to the Apollo era, I'm a solar scientist, so I'm going to say it's a really beautiful event because it looks really beautiful on the sun. But between Apollo 16 and 17, there was one of the largest radiation storms ever measured. It's called the Seahorse Flare. It happened in August of 1972. We modeled what that event would have done had, you know, the astronauts been on the moon at the time. Dangerous levels of radiation are accelerated with those very big events. And these particles, by the way, travel at about half the speed of light. So actually being able to watch the sun's surface, which we do, you know, we have other instrument, you know, other missions in the fleet, like the Solar Dynamics Observatory that stares at the sun 24/7. And so looking at these active regions, looking at predicting when and how they may erupt is really, really critical. having IMAP actually measuring what is coming towards the Earth, working out, you know, how to protect our astronauts, giving the engineers the data so they know how to shield the astronauts. It's a kind of a full package.
You know, are we entering, and pardon the pun here, Nikki, are we entering a new dawn when it comes to solar science? We have the Parker Solar Probe, we've got IMAP now. Like, scientists like yourself are getting so much data about our star, right?
We really are. I mean, obviously, I'm excited about Parker Solar Probe, and I'm happy to talk about that all day. And that mission has behaved perfectly. We've actually just completed the 25th perihelion pass, close flyby through the sun's corona. And, you know, when you see the data from those close-up flybys from the WISPA camera, the white light imager, you know, and you think, my God, that's what the atmosphere of a star looks like. You know, before this, we've only ever been able to model it. Now you're flying through it and you can actually kind of see it because of the data coming back from Parker. Parker Solar Probe is actually providing the data to say, hey, these are the processes that are going on right up close to the sun. And so that's what's fueling these models. And so we are doing these sort of next generation models. And so IMAP and missions like it are really making the measurements for the models of tomorrow. I'll also say two more missions launched with IMAP. You know, we had three missions on that stack as we are really embracing this idea of getting more science into space for less. It was a big rideshare mission for us with the being honored to partner with NOAA and take their space weather follow-on L1 mission, which is providing the, you know, the operational space weather forecasting for the nation. So, you know, they are taking the measurements of the models today because that's what we, you know, that's what we have, that's what we need. IMAP taking that data because it's actually going to be a backup in case there's a, you know, an anomaly, but also taking much more data so we can actually fuel the next generation models. The third mission on the stacks is the Carruthers GeoCorona Observatory, and that is going to be taking measurements of kind of the final piece of our atmosphere before you get to deep space. In Apollo 16, actually back to Apollo 16, there was a camera that was designed by George Carruthers at the Naval Research Lab. The astronauts took that to the moon and they took images of our exosphere. They discovered that it glows as sort of a geocorona. It's like a corona around our planet. They couldn't even get a big enough image. They didn't have enough of a field of view from the moon, but it's the most beautiful image that we have of our exosphere. That is literally the last boundary between us and space. And so Carruthers will be providing that information. How does our atmosphere change and how does it shield us from the dangers of what's coming to us from the sun?
You're listening to Are We There Yet? From Central Florida Public Media. I'm Brendan Byrne. We're speaking with Nikki Fox, the Associate Administrator for the Science Mission Directorate at NASA, about some really cool sun science missions that just launched. Nikki, I want to pivot to Mars because NASA announced an awesome finding that there are potential biosignatures on the surface of Mars. Tell us about this. This is what you all have been looking for years now, right?
I can't be more excited. It also shows the value of science exploration of Mars. You know, the effort and the thought and the planning that goes into taking those samples. Perseverance is in regions where people couldn't go. As we do the remote and the robotic exploration, we can send our missions into areas that people couldn't go. Perseverance has just done this very, very intentional exploration of Mars. We started off in Jezero Crater, took some great samples of, you know, what's sort of on the bed of an ancient river. Perseverance has gradually traversed out and up the crater rim. It's now on the rim. It's been taking amazing images and then really, you know, looking at, okay, this is an interesting rock. It doesn't look like something around it. Like, you know, really taking the time before we actually take that sample. This one is very interesting. It is in an outcrop and a Bright Angel is the area that it's in Tiava Falls. Took images and thought that doesn't look like anything around it. Of course, the instant thing you want to say is, oh, that must be, you know, a sign of ancient life. We took our time. We started with it's everything but life, you know, and you start knocking off all the other things that could have caused. It's basically, it's a change. So you can see something here. And then when you see it here, it's changed. So a process has happened that's actually changed it. And so, you know, what we think it is basically like food for a microbe, like breakfast, and then essentially poop. It's the excrement of a microbe. We really tried to say, well, you know, heat, intense heat could have caused that change. But there's no sign of intense heat. But there's none of these signatures in the sample itself or in the rocks itself. We actually think that there's a sign of some sort of life form. That doesn't mean people, but it means, you know, some sort of just a signature. There was something that was akin to life on Mars.
We talked to astrobiologists on the show before, and they want to get their hands on these samples, right? So we can test it here on Earth. How are you going to kind of further that investigation into the sample to really be able to say this possibly was signs of life when things like Mars sample return are on the chopping block and funding is getting cut for sciences? How are we able to get this back and really confirm that this could be ancient poop on Mars?
I look at this as an opportunity. You know, we are certainly adjusting. We are, you know, we respect the administration priorities to lower the overall spending. This is a time that we need to get creative. This is a time that we actually need to look at different ways of maybe being able to bring these samples back. And so, you know, we're excited to work with the administration and look at what a return of these samples might look like. It's not in the immediate future, but we can certainly say we've learned so much when we bring samples back. You know, look at what we've done with the Apollo samples. The samples we just brought back from Bennu with the OSIRIS-REx mission, showing that there are all the ingredients for life in those samples. You know, there's all the amino acids, the bases, they're all there. And there's even a saline kind of atmosphere, like a soup. But there's no sign of life. There's nothing on there that shows us that there was life in there. But why not? You know, how does it have these? And I think that, you know, they are these amazing questions that we like to ask. We do have other ways of being able to search for the ingredients of life. Obviously, we have Europa Clipper heading out towards Europa to actually fly through. We're hoping plumes that are coming up from underneath that frozen crust. And maybe in those plumes, we may be actually be able to detect all the things. And now we know what we're looking for as well. You know, maybe we'll be able to detect those. We have Dragonfly moving towards a launch later this decade. It's a drone the size of like an SUV, and it's going to go and fly over Titan. And Titan is the only place that we know in the solar system where liquid oceans actually exist. So let's go see what's on Titan. We are using our amazing astrophysics telescopes, the James Webb Space Telescope, even now without the coronagraph technology, is still able to resolve atmospheres around distant planets, around different stars, because we're looking for, again, an atmosphere that could support life. Can't wait to launch Nancy Grace Roman Space Telescope next year. Not only is it going to, you know, tell us all about dark matter and dark energy, which of course is the fabric of our universe, but it's also got a tech demo of a stellar coronagraph. And so it's going to be able to block out the light of a distant star so we can really look at the atmospheres of the planets around it. You know, that's amazing. And so, yes, of course, I'd love to bring these samples back. Once you get your hands on the samples, you can do a lot more than you can with just doing that on the surface of Mars. But boy, can we do a lot with our remote measurements.
Very exciting science on the horizon. Nikki Fox is overseeing it all for NASA. She is the Associate Administrator for the Science Mission Directorate at NASA. Nikki, thank you so much for joining us and bringing us up to speed on all this cool science.
Thank you for having me.
That's going to do it for this week's show. If you're not already, be sure to subscribe to the show's podcast feed so you never miss an episode. Do that on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Stay connected to this show. Follow us on social media. You can find us on Instagram and Facebook. Our handle is at @AWTYSpace. And if you got an idea for a future episode of the show, or you want to join us as a guest, reach out. Our email is arewetheryet@cfpublic.org. Are We There Yet? Is a production of Central Florida Public Media. Our intern is Orion Boone. Our producer is Marion Summerall. Central Florida Public Media's director of audio content is Brad Waldo. Editorial guidance comes from Latoya Dennis. Support for Are We There Yet? Comes from our listeners. Until next week, I'm Brendan Byrne. Thanks for listening.